A very good afternoon, morning or day. My name is Dirk Pilat. I'm a GP in Northeast Essex and the Medical Director for E-Learning and Accreditation at the Royal College of GPs. Today I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Ridd, a GP in Bristol, who's going to introduce himself.
Hello, I'm Matthew Ridd. I'm a GP and reader at the Centre for Academic Primary Care at the University of Bristol. I've spent the majority of my time there undertaking research, and over the last 10 years or so, the main focus of my research has been around eczema, atopic eczema or atopic dermatitis.
Which is, of course, incredibly fortuitous, because today we're going to have a little chat about eczema. In the second EKU update, we featured a module on eczema based on the guidance by the Primary Care Dermatology Society. And today we're not going to discuss the whole range of the guidance, but we're going to pick up some nuggets based on them. And of course, going to use Matthew's expertise and his latest research on adding a little bit to that, which hopefully is going to add to your GP management in general practice with these sometimes difficult patients. Matthew, just for those of us like myself who haven't been to university for a while and might have missed the recent clinical updates on eczema, could you just remind us on the current understanding of the pathophysiology of eczema?
So it seems to have a large genetic basis. Commonly you will see and can help in the diagnosis that there'll be a family history either in one of the parents or indeed an older sibling. Like all conditions, a combination of genes and environment that we don't completely understand. The biggest genetic link, 30-40% of cases of eczema, if you like, is around the filaggrin gene.
And what is the filaggrin gene?
Well, so it encodes for a protein that helps essentially maintain the skin barrier in normal skin. So if you think of skin as a brick wall, the epidermis as a brick wall, where you've got the skin cells and then the mortar in between the cells, it's the protein that helps maintain the integrity of that brick wall. And once that integrity is lost, not only can skin struggle to maintain the moisture, but it also can let other things from the outside in that irritate the skin and start the process.
Can not only irritate the skin, as far as I understand, but it can also get exposed to immunocompetent cells, which then trigger an immune reaction?
The work's come on tremendously in the last 10-20 years in our understanding and evidence now that you can see evidence of water loss from skin of newborn babies before their eczema even develops. And as you say, it's essentially a leakiness that can also predispose to food allergies. So evidence around the use of topical treatments that contain peanut oil, for example, associated with the development of peanut allergy later in life.
So it's really it really ties in with the other atopic diseases, doesn't it? I remember vaguely there was the atopic March mentioned a few times when I went to my last clinical update. Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
It's certainly true that you commonly see this progression or development of conditions over time. So a child with eczema is more likely later in life to develop asthma or hay fever. And, you know, various theories have been put forward in terms of why you see changes in the prevalence of eczema amongst children, so-called hygiene hypothesis driving that. But we're not at the point yet where we fully understand the gene environment interaction and what we can do to help prevent eczema, unfortunately.
I worked in a few different areas of the UK, and it always felt that some areas had a higher prevalence of eczema than others, and I always felt that might have been due to the specific populations I was looking after there. Is there a ring of truth in there?
Yeah, it's true. There are differences between different skin types. For example, some data around African Americans, for example, having a higher prevalence of eczema as an adult, around 17%, say, to 10% in a white population. You can also consider, if you look at different parts of the country, other environmental factors, water hardness, for example, has been implicated. Although, interestingly, a trial called the SWEAT trial a number of years ago, where they actually managed to install in homes in a blinded, masked fashion. So the families didn't know whether they had a water softener installed or not, but they managed to conduct this trial and didn't demonstrate any benefit to the eczema from having a water softener in the home. Further work has suggested maybe a more nuanced issue around the role of water hardness, but I wouldn't be advising people at the moment to install water softeners in the hope that it might improve their eczema.
So how common is it?
Really common, and very burdensome as well. So estimates are around, generally around 20% in a country like the UK in children. I was schooled in my as a medical student in early in my career to talk to parents in terms of it being the kind of thing that generally you could hope children would grow out. But increasingly, it's recognised that while eczema may improve, it can recur later on, just as eczema can, in fact, develop later in life for the first time. And for that reason, I think, while I think it can be well-meaning for GPs to say to parents, well, you know, your infant might have difficult to control eczema at the moment, but you know, you should grow out of it. It's not that reassuring to the parent either in that moment, and actually may not be true. So I think that'd be one message really to get at to GPs. I think, you know, provide some hope for the future. But certainly if you've got a child who develops eczema very early on with a family history of atopy and their eczema is, you know, difficult to treat, then they're much more likely to have a lifelong disease than perhaps childhood develops later onset eczema of milder severity.
Okay. I don't think we need to go much into the diagnosis of eczema, because I think most of us are able to recognize a kid or an adult with atopic dermatitis. But could you just remind us of a few pitfalls around differential diagnosis when it looks like us, what could look like eczema, but actually isn't eczema?
So it depends on the age group. I think there's been some concern amongst dermatologists that it can be potentially more difficult to diagnose in the under ones, where you might get overlap with conditions such as seborrheic dermatitis. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, of course, that the presentation of eczema can vary, you know, can be more sort of facial and even the extensors in the very young and certainly non-white skin at all. I think it as children, indeed, looking at adults, as you get into the older age groups, the classical sort of flexural presentation isn't always there, and it can be more of a diffuse presentation. But certainly in the younger children, tends to spare the nappy area.
Mm-hmm. Management of eczema or atopic dermatitis, particularly in kids, can be really, really difficult. So what would you advise your patients when it comes to emollients? What's your experience and what has the research given us on that particular topic?
Okay, so there's a recent Cochrane review that looked at all the evidence around this, and it was helpful in the sense that it did provide some reassurance that there is evidence that using moisturizer helps reduce the symptoms and flares possibly as well. But didn't really help us, because the evidence just simply isn't there as to where we should start and what families or indeed adults with eczema are likely to find most helpful. I think the key thing when you're thinking about how best to help a parent or indeed an adult with eczema in terms of the treatments, try and keep things as simple as possible, because while in principle the concept are simple, it can become very, very, very complicated. So before you start thinking about prescribing, you want to think about environmental factors. Again, limited evidence around it, but you might want to think about clothing. Cotton clothing tends to be more comfortable on the skin. Room temperature in children, maybe keeping the room a little bit on the cool side. Humidity and warmth can provoke some people's skin. And for the children, maybe thinking about maybe the use of mitts, cotton mitts, certainly keeping the nails short so that if they are scratching it, it minimizes the damage. Those kind of background things can all help. When thinking about moisturizers, well, pragmatically, again, I think if in your clinical experience you've got a moisturizer that you've, you know, prescribed over the years or had good feedback or indeed even used yourself, you may well be restricted in terms of what you can prescribe because of the variation between the different CCGs and medicine management teams in terms of what they'll let you prescribe. So we did a bit of work a few years ago looking at that. If you look across all the different CCGs in England and Wales and local health boards, they all make different recommendations around 101 different types of emollients. And some of them are contradictory. So I'm afraid while you work within your guideline, that they are different for no good reason, because there's no good evidence really much for one over the other. Although we are trying to do our best to try and improve that situation. So we're just at the moment following up the last of 550 children who've taken part in a National Institute for Health Research, so completely independent of the manufacturers of the emollients, HTA trial, comparing the four main types of emollients. So that's lotions, creams, gels and ointments. So we hope that will provide some evidence around that. It's called the best emollients for eczema trial. We hope once we've got all the data in, that will help us get a better idea of where to start. At the moment, the dictum tends to be the best emollient is the one that the patient will use, and that's fairly pragmatic. But there are lots of different moisturisers or emollients out there. And I think we need some evidence that hopefully the bee trial will provide, just to give you a better idea about where to start, because otherwise at the moment it is a bit of a lottery. Parents will often talk about trial and error process of finding something that works for them. I think if in your discussions you can say to parents, we know there are different types out there, we don't know really which is the best one to start with at the moment, and talking about the different pros and cons of the type in terms of ointments, which are cosmetically less attractive for many people, but don't contain some of the preservatives you might find in creams or lotions that might irritate the skin in themselves, versus the lighter ointments, which might be more cosmetically acceptable, particularly in maybe the older child or in hotter climates or on exposed areas of the face, like area of the body like the face, where you don't necessarily want a really heavy ointment on the skin. So all those factors to consider, including, of course, preference of the family, and pretty soon enough the aging child will pretty soon express a preference as well.
I think last year's BATHE trial threw a spanner in the works for many GPs who regularly would prescribe things for showers and bathtubs as well. Could you elaborate a little bit on that particular research?
Yeah, so if anything, I think the trial could be welcome on several fronts, but one of them is actually simplifying treatments. I think some parents can end up with multiple pots and tubes of creams and not really end up being sure what they're using when. And obviously, if you add additional treatments in, it creates a burden on top of the disease itself. So the BATHE trial was, again, an NIHR-funded HTA study, so independent of any manufacturers of these products. Very pragmatic in terms of trying to emulate what would happen in a normal practice, where children were either catered to usual skincare or usual skincare with the addition of a bath additive. Well-conducted trial, which over a decent follow-up period, didn't demonstrate any benefit from the addition of bath additives to good skincare. So kind of background environmental things you can think about, the use of regular moisturisers and topical corticosteroids is appropriate. So I think certainly for the majority of those children, and they were recruited from primary care, so should be representative of the type of parents, type of patients you and I see with mild, moderate disease. I don't think there's really much argument for their use anymore, and to focus on the topical leave-on moisturisers and corticosteroids as appropriate. You could argue that the evidence around the use of bath additives with antimicrobial is still open, because we only looked at those without antimicrobials, but again, they should be for short-term use where you do have concerns maybe about recurrent infection. And you could argue as well that there's still a question mark around the use of bath additives in adults. The CCGs and medicine management teams and local health boards and so on around the UK were quick to jump on the evidence and discourage our prescribing, appropriately so in that age group, in those circumstances. Unfortunately, some of the messaging in some of the guidance, such as from NHS England, also got mixed up, suggesting we shouldn't be prescribing any bath, shower products and so on. And that trial didn't look at that. So why the trial findings were conflated with that recommendation, the trial didn't make that recommendation. So just to be clear around that, I think the trial provides good evidence that it's not worth using bath additives in your standard eczema in children certainly under 12. Maybe consider the use of antimicrobials where there's concerns for short-term use in infected eczema. Maybe consider the use in adults, but essentially I would focus on the emollients that they can use on the skin, that they can use as a soap substitute, and the use of other anti-inflammatory treatments such as corticosteroids.
Could you give us a brief overview about which steroid for which body part, and most importantly for me, because I never seem to be understanding that, about the length of treatment, please?
Topical corticosteroids have been around for decades, as you know, as when used appropriately, are very safe. And I think that's an important message to want to be able to communicate to parents and adults alike. I think many dermatologists would agree with the statement at the moment that more harm done at the moment from underuse rather than overuse. And again, that's not that's not necessarily your or my fault. I think at medical school you're much more to be warned about the concerns about topical corticosteroids than made to feel confident around their use. And even if we feel confident when we're talking to parents about what to use when, they're likely to still get lots of contradictory advice, whether that be from even the pharmacist, the neighbour next door, or on social media and so on. So there's a lot of noise around them about the about corticosteroids. I think, like many conditions, I think you should feel comfortable with ideally one corticosteroid from each of the different potencies, whether it's mild, moderate, potent, or very potent, matching the potency of the steroid to the severity of the eczema, the site, and the age themselves. So you should feel comfortable prescribing hydrocortisone in children, for example, including the face. You'd be a lot more cautious about using potent steroids in sensitive areas like the face in a child, for example. So I think that's the starting point. Evidence does tend to show what there is around the use of topical corticosteroids, that starting, if you like, with a moderate potency rather than stepping up from a hydrocortisone might be a better thing to do, because you can end up chasing your tail in the same way as you can do if you don't use topical corticosteroids and try to treat this inflammation with just moisturizers. You'd usually expect, if you're initiating a course to get control, as it were, to see a response within 7, if not 14 days. That's generally what the guidelines would recommend. A strategy which has some evidence around it, which I'm not sure how well is known, is weekend therapy. So if you can get control through a blast of that treatment, using it for 7 to 14 days, maybe a couple of days more than you can see on the skin to settle any inflammation below the surface of the skin, is to then use it as a pulse therapy to try and maintain that position. So if you've got, eczema that's recurrently flaring, instead of waiting for the flare, using it prophylactically, just in the same way as we do inhaled corticosteroids for asthma. So so-called weekend therapy would suggest that you choose appropriate strength of steroid and use that on a two days out of 7 basis, so Saturday, Sunday, or it could be any 2 days of the week. That's just an easy way of remembering it, to use it on the weekend. On the areas that tend to flare in a prophylactic way, that can be a helpful way of maintaining the skin and potentially reducing the overall use of topical corticosteroids.
Okay, but what should our patients apply first? Steroids or emollients?
So common question from parents and clinicians about the order of application, whether you should put the moisturizer or the steroid on first. No evidence, I'm afraid, around that. I think the important thing is that you have a gap between the two, so that you're not diluting the steroids with the moisturizer. If you've got eczema into the maintenance phase, again, keeping the treatment simple is really helpful for obvious reasons. So in that situation, I might advise someone to use maybe their steroid in the flare patches in the morning, because it's less hassle and so on to apply. And then if they're using something fairly heavy, they might want to put that on at night before they go to bed, if they're kind of in that kind of maintenance regime, in which case you've not got that crossover between the steroids and the moisturizers at all. If they are using them, within a short space of each other, for example, getting moisturizer on after the bath, then they might be more pragmatic to put the moisturizer on first and then leave an interval before putting the steroid on. I think, again, pragmatically, I think you have to, apart from introducing the gap, I think the important thing is what works for the parent or the adult with the eczema in terms of their routine and making it work for them.
Thank you. That was helpful and practical. So how would you manage a possible flare or superficial infection in an eczema patient?
Well, again, so I think like most things, there's a spectrum here, isn't it? So parents may present their child to you, for example, and it may be clear that the skin is sore and inflamed, but no clinical signs of infection. And conversely, if the child's unlucky and maybe staph aureus has taken hold and scratched and so on, there may be sort of frank evidence of almost like a cellulitis type picture. It's the grey area in between which can be a bit more difficult. Might maybe look a little bit impigmatized and inflamed, and you can feel uncertain about whether there's an infective element there. So again, the role of Staph aureus on the skin in eczema isn't fully understood. We know that the skin of people with eczema is more heavily colonized with it than people without eczema, and that you see more, there's more likely to be Staph aureus present in where there's a flare than when the skin is clear or normal for that person. We were involved in a trial that was led up at Cardiff University a few years ago called the CREAM trial, which tried to provide some better evidence around that, around when there was uncertainty as to whether infection was present or not. Well-conducted trial that evaluated the use of placebo versus either topical antibiotic fusidic acid or oral antibiotic flucloxilin or an alternative if they were allergic to penicillin. And why that trial didn't recruit the target number of participants, I think it was helpful because certainly for the participants we're seeing in that trial, the majority of whom did have clinical signs of infection of one sort or another, there wasn't any additional benefit from using topical oral antibiotics in that population. So while I don't think that should change necessarily your practice if they're convincing signs and you've got a child who's unwell, because this population, this particular trial was focused on that sort of position of equipoise where there's uncertainty about whether antibiotics would add anything to the treatment. So while I think you should still be treating whether it's frank infection, if there's that sort of group where it's a bit less clear, I would encourage you, if appropriate, as happened for the majority of people in this trial, to think about stepping up their treatment, whether that be from nothing to a mild steroid or to a moderate or even potent steroid, if that's appropriate, because that there wasn't any additional benefit from using topical oral antibiotics in that group.
If we're not particularly convinced that this is infection, yeah, Avoid antimicrobials if there's no overt signs of of super infection.
That's bacteria, of course. You have to keep a lookout for other things. People, dermatologists worry about eczema herpeticum, and rightly so if it takes hold. I think the majority of GPs won't hopefully see that in the lifetime, but if you've got a child in whom you're concerned about that, then you have to be cautious in your approach. Yeah.
Okay. So
thinking about antiviral treatment rather than
If you have patients who seem to be struggling with their eczema control and seem to be flaring more often, whether it's kids or whether the patients themselves, and they might come back to you and say, doctor, don't we need some blood tests now to find out what this really is? Do you think there's a role for investigations in eczema, particularly around specific IgE?
You know, dermatologists refer to it as atopic eczematous dermatitis, but obviously for the majority of our patients, particularly children, we don't do blood tests to see if they've got an elevated IgE. The label of generally calling it eczema is appropriate, though of course there are other types of eczema, so you need to be clear with patients you're talking about what dermatologists refer to as atopic eczema dermatitis rather than other types of eczema. And I think that's relevant because, as we've already discussed, eczema does often fit in with other atopic conditions later in life, such as asthma and in the hay fever. And related to that, food allergies are more common amongst children with eczema. I think the confusion arises around the role of food allergy as a possible driver for the eczema. And it relates back to the earlier part of the conversation around the role of the skin barrier and the potential for allergens to come through that skin barrier and set up abnormal allergic reactions to proteins that get into the body that way, such as peanut and so on. While food allergies are more common in children with eczema, it's usually of the immediate type. So a child might meet peanut or whatever for the first time and have that sort of classical reaction of maybe looking, appearing a bit distressed, tachypneic, flushed, vomit, diarrhea, that sort of classical symptoms that you get as a part of a food reaction within 2 hours. And often the clinical diagnosis itself will nail it. You may, majority of GPs won't necessarily want or have access to either blood tests or skin prick tests if that's needed to confirm the diagnosis. So you might want to seek the advice of local allergists for advice around confirming the diagnosis or management, but particularly in terms of follow-up, if you've got an egg allergy, for example, where fortunately the majority of children will outgrow it, you'll still, I'm sure, seek the input of the local allergy term in terms of further testing and thinking about reintroducing to that diet later on. More tricky is the question around children with eczema, where there isn't any sort of immediate obvious link between ingestion of any possible allergenic food and the development symptom within hours, whereas the parent might feel that, you know, over the course of days, maybe the milk or egg or one of the other common allergens is driving that. And they may ask about the value of food allergy testing in that. And it's really unclear whether that's a helpful thing to do. I think GPs, because there are so many other things to talk about already in the treatment of eczema, may shy away from bringing up food allergy as a topic for conversation because time's short and you can't cover everything. But it will be a question in the back of many parents' mind if they don't raise it. If you are able to follow up appointment, if not initially, to go into that, I think it's worth exploring because you may be surprised how commonly parents do exclude foods off their own back, just trying to see if that makes a difference to their child's eczema, concerned that the underlying cause is being missed. There's no real evidence that we should be doing food allergy tests to guide them in that decision making. We want to do some research in that area because it's unclear. So we've recently conducted a feasibility trial just to see if it's possible to recruit GPs and parents into this kind of trial where we're offering randomising children to food allergy tests or not. And that was funded by the NIHR School for Primary Care Research. And we found that children, parents were really interested in this question, were willing to take part in the trial. So we want to take that forward now and provide some evidence further down the line as to when we should be, you know, routinely offering or if we should be routinely offering food allergy tests in this group with view to trying to improve their eczema symptoms long term. But essentially, the advice is at the moment, take the opportunity you can to explore concerns around food allergy. Parents are describing that kind of classic immediate type reaction to food. Then address that as you would in any, you know, any child present with eczema or not. But I always try and provide some reassurance around concerns around food allergy more generally. Otherwise, encourage parents to try and focus on the treatments, two treatments used well. And for the majority of children, that will be sufficient to manage their eczema.
What do you think are your most important pieces of advice for your patient when it comes to self-management?
So again, I'll repeat the message. Two treatments well used well. If you can think about things in the environment that might help, then that's great. Otherwise, a moisturiser that if can be used as a soap substitute, one moisturiser, ideally it can be used as one soap, and as a substitute that they're happy to use regularly. You may be able to use it twice daily. That might be the only pragmatic way of using it, maybe in a school-aged child. But certainly for babies, you might want to encourage it's used, you know, at every nappy change and so on, and being confident about how to use that. So looking at the videos that are available online in terms of application of the moisturiser. And similarly, having one, maybe two different strengths of steroid and feeling confident about using that when the skin is red and sore and knowing which treatment to use in which part of the body is key, really. And then obviously, if despite following that regime, they're not getting or keeping control, then seeking advice and thinking about possibility of infection, particularly with, you know, uncommon but serious infections such as eczema herpeticum.
You've mentioned signposting them to online resources. What's your favorite one?
So in terms of putting it all together, we did some work with parents and GPs to develop a written action plan. So most GPs, I expect, will be familiar with them. And with their evidence base around their use in asthma, which has many parallels. Obviously, many of these children will go on to develop asthma, but there are many parallels with the condition in terms of it being a relapse and a limiting long-term condition where you need to step up and step down treatment. So as a result of that work, we then developed an eczema written action plan in an EWAP. And so that's freely available for people to download and use. So you can download it from bristol.ac.uk/EWAP. And on the back of that, on the front, there's some space for the parent, ideally to fill in with their GP or nurse practitioner or dermatologist, indeed, in terms of what treatment they're going to use, where and when. And then on the back, there's some links to some information there. So there are resources available, such as the National Eczema Society, which I expect most people will know. There's also some good information available from the NHS website. Less well known is Eczema Outreach. It's a charity based in Scotland and got some links to some useful resources. And there's another group in Nottingham called Nottingham Eczema Support Group for Carers of Children with Eczema. Again, they've got some good information there. But essentially, if you go to the website, you can click directly links to some videos that you might want to share with parents, or indeed they can look them up themselves.
Brilliant. Well, that's going to help lots of GPs who are listening today to steer their patients to self-management. instructions.
Yeah, so hopefully that document as a written information might be helpful. Obviously, a lot of parents turn to the web for information, and I've signposted some information that is kind of should be reliable information. Obviously, as with any condition, there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. So currently involved with a trial being led by colleagues in the University of Southampton, looking at an online platform to support self-management, which is full of evidence-based information. So that's the ECO trial. So hopefully we'll be finding out the results from that later this year, next year rather, in 2021. And depending on whether that's a positive evaluation or not, hopefully that will be available later down the line for patients to access and to supplement what information they can get from their GPs and dermatology colleagues.
Matthew, it's so reassuring to know that there is so much more evidence around eczema coming on stream very soon, which of course is going to help us in the management of our patients. And that just leaves me to say thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute delight. For everybody out there, most importantly, be safe. I hope your resilience is currently fully loaded. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.